I don't know about you, I love this time of the year. The Christmas is in the air, the carols are playing everywhere, all the music stations, decorations are up, you can smell it, right, that tree. And the kids are getting giddy because school's almost out, especially those of you who are in school or teachers or have kids. You know, they're just looking forward to next week when they will finally have no school. Now, I just discovered a radio, Christian radio station, 91.7, that I used to listen to when I lived in Virginia. My wife pointed it out on the billboard, and so I tuned to it immediately, and I started listening to it. And it's this old-fashioned Bible network type of a music station that they only really play old pastors, actually now mostly dead pastors' sermons, and they only play old hymns, so they don't play any of the contemporary music. And those of you who know how I sing, you know why I sing the way I do, because I grew up on that stuff. I never really listened to any contemporary Christian music, but there's old opera, like, you know, hymns and so on. So I rediscovered that station. It finally came to Washington State. And so now I've been listening to it. And one of the things that they do is that in December, just like all the other Christian radio stations or even regular secular radio stations, they only play Christmas music. But the niche, their niche is that they only play Christian Christmas music. In other words, they don't play Jingle Bells, Sleigh Bells, Santa Claus is Coming, or Santa Baby, and all these songs, because they're not, quote-unquote, Christmas music. So they only play Christ-honoring, Christian-related Christmas music. And so that hearkened me back to, what is Christmas really about? Are we missing out on what Christmas season really is about in light of all the things that are going around? C.S. Lewis, in his book, Great Divorce, says this. He said, "There have been men before who got so interested in proving the existence of God that they came to care nothing for God himself, as if the good Lord had nothing to do but to exist. There have been some who were so preoccupied with spreading Christianity that they never gave a thought to Christ. And I may add, there have been some who are so in love with the Christmas season that they left Christ out of it." And so easy to do. But Christmas is special because it proves that God is with us. The baby, newborn baby, he was called to be Emmanuel. And it literally means God. El means God. Emmanuel means with us. And so it's God with us. And on Christmas Day 2,000 years ago, God became a human being and he decided to be one of us and to live with us. And that's exactly the reason for the season, and that's what Christmas signifies, and that's what Christmas means, that God came to dwell with man. But what does it mean? What are the implications of God being with us? How does that benefit us? And I want to go over at least three implications, and I'm sure there are so many more, but at least three implications. And the first one is, it means God's protection of us. God with us, God living with us, God's protection of us. Number two, it's God's identification with us. And then thirdly, it means God's purpose will be fulfilled in us. Okay, so let's go one by one. Number one, God's protection of us. God with us is what that means. So Psalm 23:4, you're pretty familiar with this psalm, probably the most famous psalm. It says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? "Because you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." So the psalmist David is saying, the Lord is my shepherd and I shall not fear anything at all. Why? "Because the Lord is with me. And he has his rod and he has his staff." And what is he going to use them for? I used to think when I was little, growing up in an Asian country where you get beat a lot by your parents and also your teachers, I thought of God as this shepherd with a big stick. And if you do something wrong, he go whack. Right? You're not paying attention in Sunday school? Whack. That's what his rod and his staff are for. But that's not how David is picturing it. That's not what they're for. They are for the wolves. They are for the evil ones that are trying to steal his sheep. And so they're for our protection, that he carries a big stick. And so God's protection is there for those who are God's children, who are his sheep. And that's how he protects us. Here's another verse. Hebrews 13 says, keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Kind of interesting how he puts that famous first verse, I will never leave you nor forsake you, in light of the money. You know, we worry so much about money. What happens if I lose my job? What happens to my 401k? What happens if Social Security goes away? Well, God is saying, I'll be with you. Don't worry about it. Right? But anyway, besides the point. And then verse 6, it says, so we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Okay. So again, because I am with you, I will never leave you nor forsake you. You should not fear anyone, and you particularly should not fear man. But we do fear man, don't we? Our response should be, you know, I will fear no one. I will do whatever God tells me to do. I will not fear ISIS, for example, even if they threat to cut off my family or my head. I will not fear them because they're simply men. God is my shepherd. I shall not be fearful. I should not fear losing my job. Every time your boss says something to you that you don't like, what do you fear? Am I going to get fired? Especially if you just got hired, right? You think that, don't you? Yeah, even as a pastor, when I first got hired as a youth pastor for the first year, man, if my senior pastor ever called me into his office, I'm thinking, I'm fired. I did something wrong. What did I do? You worry about that. And God is saying, no, don't worry about it. I'll never leave you nor forsake you. That means I shouldn't fear losing my friendship by telling her something that she needs to hear. We fear that, don't we? If I told her that, oh, man, our friendship, 15 years friendship is gone. God is saying, no, you shall not fear man. Right? You shall only fear God. After all, what can men do to us? Is the logic. Well, the fact is that they can do a lot. Men can do a lot to us, can't they? They can kill us. For example, we heard yet another news, unfortunate news, on last two Wednesdays ago. A couple, radical Islamist couple, opened firing on workers in San Bernardino, killing, I believe, 14 and injuring 21. And I am sure that some of those people who are dead are Christians. So the question had to be asked, wait a minute, Christians die just like non-Christians. As a matter of fact, Christians are targeted in certain parts of the world by the radical Islamists. Are you a Christian? Yes, bullet to the head. And they die. But isn't God with them? Isn't God supposed to protect these Christians? And yet, apparently, they die at the same rate as non-Christians. If not, even at a greater rate or even earlier pace than the non-Christians. So in what sense is God protecting us? If he's not protecting us from death. This one really hit home with us, you know, when my wife Janet told me about it maybe a month ago now, a pastor's wife, a young wife with a one-year-old at home, and her husband, who's a pastor, a young pastor, just had left his home to go to work. And she was home by herself with the child, and she was also pregnant with a child, and two teenagers barged into her room, and then when she put up a fight, well, basically they shot and killed her, and I'm sure the baby inside her womb, and the one-year-old who was sleeping in his room fortunately was not touched, but that wife died. Pastor, right, whom God is with, and I'm sure he was with the wife too, but dead with the baby inside. Where is God's protection in this? Why didn't God protect her? Wasn't God with her when that happened? Did God sleep? Did God make a mistake? So what does it mean when he says, I'll protect you, I'll never leave you nor forsake you, and yet these things happen to Christians just like it happens to anybody else? So it obviously does not mean that God protects us from death. Because let's face it, if God protects you this morning from swerving into, or somebody swerving into your car and killing you on the spot, you will die someday. It's guaranteed. So it's not that God protects us from death, but God protects us from something greater than death. There is something greater evil than death itself. Death is not the worst thing, is it? It happens to all of us. What is the worst thing? Hell. Separation from God. Ultimately, that's what God protects us from. The greatest evil of all. He protects his children from hell. And separation, eternal separation from him. So to back this up, let me read Matthew 10:28. Jesus says, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell." So Jesus is acknowledging people can kill you. Oh yes, they can kill you. They will kill me too. If they kill the master, me, Jesus, the Son of God, don't you think they will kill you? Yes, they will, but don't fear them. Because even though they may kill your body, they cannot destroy your soul. But fear him who not only kills the body, but also destroys the soul forever. Fear him. So God's protection is not simply just on earth. And I do believe in a certain extent, God does protect us from physical harm. Yes, I do believe that. Until it is God's timing, until God's will is done, yes, we will be invincible. You can think of yourself like that. No stray bullet will just randomly hit you and God didn't think about that. If you're dead, then it's time for you to go and God willed it. And so in that sense, yes, God does protect us physically in that way too. But ultimately what he protects us from is eternal death, eternal separation from him. As a matter of fact, did you know that early death might be a sign of God's protection? God trying to protect some of his children, he will take them home early to protect them from further evil. That's in the Bible. Where is it? Isaiah 57, verses 1 and 2. Let me read it to you. "Good people pass away. The godly often die before their time. But no one seems to care or wonder why. No one seems to understand that God is protecting them from the evil to come." Did you hear it? Some people die young. We don't know why. They're godly people. They love the Lord. And then bam, died. Next moment. Why? Nobody understands. But it says here, God is protecting them from the evil to come. For those who follow godly paths will rest in peace when they die. We don't know their future. Maybe God foresaw their future, and he saw that if he lived on, then something evil, maybe he would have been separated from God. Who knows? God knew that. "I want to take you home. It is better that you're home with me than here on earth." So he takes them home. So God with us means God will protect us from the ultimate evil of life without God in hell. And I take comfort in that. I don't have to worry about protecting my own life. Not that I make stupid decisions and so on, but no. Ultimately, I'm on God's table, and I am protected not only spiritually, but physically until it is time for me to see him face to face. So God's protection. God with us means God's protection. Number two, God with us means that God's identification is with us. God identifies with us. God becoming a man, he knows not omnisciently because he knows all things, but now he knows because he has experienced it. He has gone through the same thing we have gone through because he became a man. He became a baby, and he knows what it is to be in a womb, and he knows what it is to have a mother and father telling him what to do. He knows what it is to have a fight with his friends and what it is to have a conflict with his brothers because he had younger brothers, and he knows what it is to have a sexual temptation, for example, because he was a single man. Do you remember that? 30 years old, when he started his ministry, when he died, he was about 33. And so he was a man with the hormone going through his body. So he knows all of the sexual temptations that you and I know. Jesus Christ, we're talking about. So he wasn't this angel. He wasn't this robot that felt nothing and he just went through it. No, he felt all the things that you and I feel. And yet, without sin, he knows the sorrows, he knows the pain and hurts, he knows the sadness, loneliness, disappointments. Hebrews 4:15 says, "For we do not have a high priest," talking about Jesus, "who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." That's Jesus. He has been tempted in every way as we are, and yet without sin. So let's be a little more specific on what Jesus might have known. He knew what it is to grow up in a home where there was no father. Many of you have grown up in a home where there was no father. Jesus knows. He grew up in a home where there was no father. Joseph, the Bible scholars agree that he probably died at an early age when Jesus was still young. So he was raised by a single mom, Mary. He knows. Jesus knows what it is to go through struggles with siblings. You have siblings that you don't talk to, that you wish they weren't your siblings, and you lament about that. Jesus knows what that is like. He had four siblings, and the Bible says that they didn't believe in him until after his resurrection. The whole time they were doubting him. It's like, "You're crazy. Like, who do you think you are?" The whole time. If you got siblings like that with you, that are cynical to you, then he knows. Jesus knows what it is to be nagged by his mother. You got a naggy mom. Jesus tells Mary at a wedding, "Woman, my time is not yet. Why are you bothering me?" Right? That's not a license, young people, to talk to your mother that way. I mean, Jesus, even though he was a son, he was her Lord. So he can talk to anybody like that. But we don't do that. But you can see that he was annoyed by his own mother. "Woman, my time is..." I talk to my mom like that? And my mom has a hand as big as mine, really. That wouldn't be fun. Anyway, so he knows what it is to be nagged by his mother. What else did Jesus know? He knew what it is to be abandoned by friends at the most critical moment. Remember when the Roman soldiers to take him away, what did the disciples do? They all ran away. All his friends that he has been with for 3 years all ran away. You feel betrayed. All your coworkers are talking about you behind your back, and you feel so lonely and alone. All the years of investment in friendship, poof, just like that. Well, Jesus knows. He's gone through that. And then he certainly knew what it is to be lonely and to be even abandoned by God, because he was forsaken. He was forsaken. He was left by God, his Father, when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, you and I will never be forsaken, because Jesus promised, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." So you and I, even though we may feel like we're abandoned and forsaken, you and I will never actually be forsaken. But Jesus was forsaken. He was left by the Father. And so even if we are feeling at the pit of our loneliness and abandonment, feeling abandoned, Jesus still knows what that feels like, because he has gone through it himself. He identifies with us. And you know, as a young man many years ago, I can't tell you how consoling that is. I married when I was 34, so kind of late, and so I was single all those years, and it wasn't like I was dating around, and so I always had somebody with me. But you know, most of my years, and especially because of my position too, you know, being a pastor, and not too many people want to be friends with a pastor, and so, you know, I spent most of my years alone, and there were those lonely nights, you know, on Saturday nights, here I am alone, or with kids that don't understand. I mean, seventh graders and eighth graders, and I'm planning for the retreat, you know, here he is, you know, 30-something year old, you know, and no friends and no girlfriend, and just playing with kids, like, where is my life going? What is it going to lead to? You know, there is a pang of loneliness that I just wish that there was somebody that I could talk to who would understand with me, who identify with me and tell me that I'm doing okay. You been there? Oh, Jesus has been there many, many, many times. But he was a son of God. Right? He understood far more than anybody who's ever lived. Nobody could understand him. And I think he did it for a purpose, so that you and I today could look at him and go, "Jesus, wow, you know how I feel. You're there. I'm never alone because you're there." Jesus went through all those temptations and never sinned. And that's where we don't kind of can't identify with him, because we have sinned. In our lonely moments, we have called up somebody that we shouldn't have, perhaps our old flame, you know. In those moments, you know, sexual temptation, we have done things that we shouldn't have. You know, alcohol, you know, drugs come into picture too. But Jesus, at all those moments when temptations came, he was spotless and he was sinless. And that's where we go, I don't get that, you know. That does not make me feel good because I gave him, Jesus didn't. So how is that supposed to help me? Because I failed. If Jesus is simply our example, yes, all he can do is make us feel bad. Because I've done it perfectly. Why don't you? Why can't you follow my example? Why can't you follow my example? Try harder. Well, I can't. Try, Jesus. But thank goodness, Jesus is not simply our example. But Jesus is our substitute. Hallelujah. Man, that is the greatest fact. That is the greatest piece of truth the world needs to know. That Jesus is my substitute. He has performed perfectly, and he has won away, and he has won over all those temptations, and he has given me and you the credit once we have decided that we're going to trust him and treasure him more than anything else. So it's as if you have wielded off all those temptations perfectly. It's as if you're still a virgin. It's as if you have never drank, as if you have never used drugs. It's as if you never had a husband or wife that divorced you. Clean slate, because Jesus lived that life. He came to identify with us, lived a life that we should have lived it perfectly, and has given us as the credit. That's what Christmas means, God with us. Lastly, thirdly, so not only God with us means that God's protection of us, and then number two, God's identification with us, and then number three, that God's purpose will be fulfilled in us. Ultimately, eventually, God's purpose for us will be fulfilled. There will be nobody on earth who's a Christian. God's going to say, you know what? I gave you that assignment. You failed. Or ultimately, I wanted you to become like me, but you didn't try hard enough. And so, no, I'm sorry. I can't let you in. No. If you're a child of God, if you're a genuine born-again Christian, in the end, you will have achieved God's purpose. And that is to become like his son. Really, that is the ultimate purpose, is that you and I resemble God's son in his character. And you will become that if you are a born-again believer. It's a guarantee, every single one of us. Romans 8:29 says this, "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many believers, many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified." That means if you are chosen by God, if you are a born-again Christian, it's not because one day you thought, you know what, that life is better than this life. I want to be a Christian because I want to go to heaven, and you decided that. No, you didn't decide that. God picked you, and that's why you decided it. And if that's what happened, then God's going to see to it that you become a child of God in character. Not just legally. Yes, that's true. The moment that we have received Jesus Christ as our Savior and as our pleasure source and as our treasure, yes, you become a Christian, you become a child of God. But from that point on, most Christians think, okay, God saved us. Now it's up to me to make myself look like Jesus Christ, right? I need to clean up my act. I need to oomph up this moral strength that is in me and willpower that is in me, and then I'm going to try to make myself look like Jesus because God saved me. I can't ask him to do more, so it's up to me to make myself clean and acceptable before God. That's not how it works. That is not Christianity. Christianity works in that God saves us, and as we are depending on him, as we are finding our pleasure in him, that our hearts are changed, and with the changed heart, we are making the effort out of pleasure. So is there effort involved in Christianity? Yes, there is. Grace is not opposed to effort, only to earning. What's wrong? What opposes grace? What opposes God saving us? Is us trying to earn God's favor. If I live the right life, if I go to church, if I don't say cuss words, if I don't drink, if I don't smoke, then God's going to accept me in the end. That's not it. That's not Christianity. That's every other religion. But Christianity is, wow, while I was doing all those things, God sent his son to die for me. What a great savior. Why would he do that? I love him. And so these things that I've been doing that do not make him happy, I don't want to do those things anymore. I'll try to stay away from those things, not so that I will be accepted by God, but because I'm already accepted by God, in order to please him, I just won't do those things anymore. Yes, we go back to those things. We do. I do. But at those moments, we go, you know what? This is, here's a difference. Here's how you know whether you are living a moralistic Christianity or true spiritual Christianity. Those of you who grew up with a hard kind of, you know, legalistic church background, you gotta do this, you gotta wake up at 6:30 and have your quiet time or you're a bad Christian. If you miss a church, you're a bad Christian. This is the way you think, and this is the way I used to think for the longest time. When you sin, what is it that is making you want to stop? If you grew up in a legalistic Christian background, this is what you think. When you sin, you think, you know what, if I keep on doing this, God's going to punish me. So I need to stop. That's legalism. You know how you would think if you're brought up in a grace-based type of teaching? When you sin, you think, if I keep on doing this, I'll keep on hurting my Lord. So I need to stop. In the first instance, if I keep on doing this, God's going to punish me. Who are you thinking about? You. You're the center of it. You don't want to do this because you're going to get punished. You don't want to suffer the consequences, and so you want to stop. It's all about you. But in the second one, if I keep on doing this, it will hurt my Lord. I don't want to hurt him. What is the motive? Jesus is the motive. Your relationship with him is the motive. Huge difference. That's Christian maturity. Let me give you this illustration. Christianity is not like an effort of a student to get on the good side of a hard teacher. I want to be his favorite pet, right? Favorite student. So if I make 95 on the next test, I try really hard, make 95, then I'm going to be his pet. Most people think that's Christianity. But true Christianity is more like effort of a lover to find out what pleases his beloved and to do it because it pleases him. Let me give you an illustration. So this past week, I went to the mall. I went to two malls, Tacoma Mall and South Hill Mall. I'm a middle-aged man. I don't do malls. Okay, last place I want to be during Christmas time is at the mall. Yes, when I was a teenager, I used to go to the mall, just like all the other teenage girls and teenage boys, really to see and check out girls and to be seen and, you know, all of that, but middle-aged man, that's not very attractive anymore. So, you know, I went to the mall. Why? Because I wanted to look for a gift for my little girls. I saw online this cutesy Frozen-themed necklace. And so I wanted to go to the mall to see if they had it, rather than waiting a couple of days to order it online, and they did. JCPenney had the one I wanted. But they didn't have two of them because I have two girls and I got to buy them the exact same thing. And so I went all the way to the other mall, South Hill Mall, you know, going to the same store and also Sears to see if they have a lower price and, you know, me. So I did all of that. And in the middle of doing this, it occurred to me, why am I doing this? Why am I making this effort? Am I making this effort to earn their love? Am I doing this by giving them, Senna and Sari, these necklaces, and in the end, I hope they accept me as their father? Is that what it is? No, I do this because I want to please them. I love them. I want to show them how much I care for them. Right? I don't have to do this, but I want to do this. Because they're already my daughter. I'm already their father. That's Christian faith. That's Christian effort. Do you see the difference? We are not doing this. We are not being moralistic. We are not coming to church. We are not reading the Bible. We are not staying away from these things so that God will accept us at the end. But no, because he has already accepted us, he has already given us the credit for his son, we go, I want to be like that son. Right? I want to be worthy. I love you. I want to know what that joy is like becoming like your son. That's Christianity. That's grace-based effort. 2 Corinthians 3:18, "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another." Do you know how we become transformed as Christians? Do you know how we become mature as Christians, people? Here's a key. It says, beholding the glory of the Lord. When we see the face of the Lord, when we see how beautiful Jesus is, when we know how gracious Jesus is, forgiving he is, we automatically want to become like him. Haven't you realized that about yourself? You become like who you hang out with. You become like who you like, don't you? And that's why as parents, we worry when our teenagers mix up with the wrong crowd. Why? Because they will become like them. They will do the same things that they do. You become like the people that you like, that you hang out with. And Jesus is saying, God is saying, you want to become like my son? Hang out with him. Behold his glory. You will automatically become like him because you will want to. Your heart will change. And you will make the kind of efforts that is grace-driven, that will give you more joy because you're becoming like the person, my son, who had the most joy or who is the source of joy. Philippians 1:6, "And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Christ." So in other words, if you are genuinely, truly a child of God, that will be happening, that is happening in your heart, in your life right now. If that is not happening, that means you have never become a child of God. Doesn't mean that God has somehow, we have somehow fallen out of that formula. It just means that we have never really become. We have never really given up control over our life. We have never really wanted Jesus to be that person, our treasure. We just wanted what we wanted. But God is guaranteeing that if truly, genuinely, you're a child of mine, this will be happening. Albeit very, very slowly. It takes a lifetime and it will never be completed. Because even Paul said that, not that I've reached perfection, so none of us will reach there, but that work will have begun, and God will make sure that it comes to a completion. If not here in this life, and most of us know, it will be completed in the next life in heaven. So God comes to live with us, and when he does that, we become like him. Let me conclude. One of my favorite Christmas songs is called "Mary, Did You Know?" And the second stanza of that song goes like this. So Mary, mother of Jesus, is what this song is about. It says, "Mary, did you know that your baby boy will give sight to a blind man? Mary, did you know that your baby boy will calm a storm with his hand? Did you know that your baby boy has walked where angels trod? And when you kiss your little baby, you have kissed the face of God." Imagine little Mary, teenage girl, with Jesus in her arm, looking right at him, looking at the face of God. The face of God that Moses could not look at in the Old Testament, that if Moses were to look at the face of God, that he would instantly be incinerated and die on the spot because God was so holy. But this Mary was holding the baby Jesus in her hand, looking straight into the face of God, and she could kiss the face of God. Imagine that. "Oh, Mary, did you know? The blind will see, the deaf will hear, the dead will live again, the lame will leap, the dumb will speak the praises of the Lamb." Folks, there had really been only one special child. Your baby, as special as your baby is and my babies are, they're really not that special. There are 7 billion others just like them. But there was one that was really special. And that was Jesus. The baby Jesus. He became blind with blood pouring down on his eyes from his head so that you and I could see. He became deaf with the deafening noise of people yelling, "Crucify him, crucify him," so that we could hear his sweet voice. His heart was pierced on the edge of a spear so that your heart and my heart could beat as one with God's heart. And his feet became lame, having the nail go through the bones of his feet so that you and I could walk, run, and tumble all the days of our eternal lives in bliss in heaven. That is what Christmas is about. He came to protect you. He came to identify with you. And he is working in you to make your life be like his son. Let's pray.